From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Welcome to another in our series of Rudman Center Conversations with the Candidates, coming to you from the Rudman Center at UNH School of Law. Our guest tonight is congressional candidate Frank Ginta, a Republican from the 1st District. Our next guest on October 20th is Walt Havenstein, the Republican nominee for governor. I'd also like to thank the sponsors of this series, Eastern Bank and Dartmouth-Hitchcock Medical Center. Throughout the hour, in addition to my own questions, we'll be sharing questions we received from our listeners before this event, and we'll take questions from our audience here at the Rudman Center. And Congressman Ginta, welcome, and it's nice to see you.
Well, thank you very much, Laura. It's great to be back with you.
Well, let's start with looking at why you want to go back to Congress after 2 years out. You've said you're hoping to go back and find common ground without sacrificing our principles. If reelected, Congressman Ginta, on what issues might you find common ground with Democrats?
Well, I think there's very serious and significant issues that the next Congress is going to undertake, regardless of whether the Senate remains Democrat or Republican, and regardless of how the House makeup is going to turn out. That being said, I think through the appropriations process, which starts in the beginning of the year, there are three things that I'd like to focus on, trying to utilize the money from New Hampshire that goes to Washington, bring it back here, in three main areas. Number one, safety and security. We've got significant crime-related issues throughout the state, drug-related issues throughout the state. I'd like to try to bring some of those resources back so we can have a better prepared state of New Hampshire to combat that issue. Secondly, I'd like to see more resources in the area of education. The challenge there is with money that comes from Washington tends to come mandates. We'd like to try to free up some of those mandates, allow more local control so those dollars can be utilized the way school boards and school districts would like them to be utilized. And the third area that I think we've got to do a lot of work here in New Hampshire is in the area of health and more particularly mental health. We used to be one of the best in the nation in delivering services to those who are afflicted with mental illness. We are no longer in that category as a state, and it's something that is alarming, is concerning. It's not good for the patient. It's not good for the patient's family, nor is it good for the institution that is trying to provide services to those individuals. So from the appropriations process, I would start there. Then you're going to have in April the budgeting process that begins, which sets up the amount of expenditures and the levels that you're going to see. So that will be busy. But I think in order to focus on economic growth, we've got to have tax reform, both on the individual and the corporate side. And if we can get tax reform out of the way fairly early in the year, I think it can set up an opportunity to work with the Senate and the President to try to get something accomplished that hopefully before the end of the calendar year, we can get signed into law.
So those first things you mentioned, Congressman Ginta, you know, more money for New Hampshire in terms of safety, security. Boy, a lot of people talking about the drug problem, more money for education, more money for mental health. There I could see you finding common ground with Democrats. Mm-hmm. Tax reform, it's hard to find common ground with anybody on tax reform. I mean, how are you going to do that? What kind of tax reform are you looking at where you might be able to find common ground?
I do believe that there's an opportunity in the last 2 years of the president's term to try to get something accomplished on tax reform because so many people are concerned about the economy. And there is starting to be some areas of overlap between Republicans and Democrats relative to the inversions that we're seeing. So, for example, the latest inversion was Burger King acquiring a company in Hortons in Canada. The purpose of that, essentially, among other reasons to merge, is to take advantage of the corporate tax rate in Canada, which is significantly lower than the tax rate here in the United States, which stands at 35%. If we can find now, again, there are those who want to, quote unquote, close the loophole, and then there are those who want to update the code and change the rate. But there is commonality amongst Republicans and Democrats to try to reduce the rate and close loopholes at the same time. So if you can find a subset of loopholes you want to close, but also reduce that rate, I think you can give some predictability to businesses and start to attract business to come back to the United States and then have economic growth by way of more job creation here in our country.
You know, Congressman Ginta, when you were first elected, in 2010, you ran as a strong conservative, embracing many ideas from the growing Tea Party movement at that time, from, an openness to teaching creationism in the public schools to a strong emphasis on deficit reduction. That was a big part of the Tea Party platform. And yet here you are now saying, hey, some of the first things I'd like to work on is bringing home more bacon for New Hampshire. That's interesting.
Well, for every dollar that New Hampshire sends to Washington, we only get back about 70, 71 cents in return. I don't think that's particularly fair to a small state like New Hampshire. And I don't think it's fair when those resources from New Hampshire may go to other states like New York, California, Florida, significantly larger states. I quite frankly, would like to see a dollar-for-dollar return.
Although it's probably because we're wealthier, though, isn't it? Like other states that are poor get more money in Medicaid and food stamps and stuff, and that's part of the reason why.
There are a lot of factors, but when I served on the Transportation Committee, for example, in the 112th Congress, we were able to find, but not by raising taxes, but by working with the existing formula to provide an extra $60 million back to the state of New Hampshire. Now, you no longer can earmark. Those dollars were then disseminated through the legislative process here in the state of New Hampshire. Most of that money went into I-93 and completing that expansion. So there are ways that you can manage the resources, the financial resources, and ensure that your state is receiving a fair share on a merit-based system, not necessarily on any other system, but on a merit-based system. So I think that's critical to do. Look, I think we have a lot of challenges here in New Hampshire. I still feel that you can reduce spending, balance the budget, use dollars more effectively and efficiently, and get a bigger bang for your buck. I used to do that very effectively as mayor, and I would remind people I was in the minority very significantly when I was mayor. We still got a lot of those types of agenda items accomplished.
So is the importance of debt and deficits as strong as it was, 4 years ago in 2010?
It's interesting. A lot of people that I talk to when I'm campaigning, they talk about the economy, certainly, and jobs. Absolutely talk about health care. That is a driving force for individuals and businesses. And, a lot of our economy here in New Hampshire is driven by small business. And obviously, because it's going on right now, the threat that ISIS poses. Earlier in the summer, there was a lot of discussion about Israel and a lot of discussion also about President Putin. It really, on international issues, has focused almost exclusively now on ISIS. But sort of in a 1-2-3, those tend to be the issues that most people discuss when I'm campaigning. But these broader issues are just as important. Debt and deficit, I think, while not on the forefront of people's minds, I think most people want to see a balanced budget. They want to make sure that the long-term debt is not provided to our kids and our grandkids. So you still have an obligation to try to address those issues as you're serving. And I certainly talk about them if they come up in conversation. But what tends to dominate conversation right now are those three: jobs and economy, health care, and then ISIS and what's going on in Iraq and Syria.
Well, I definitely want to talk to you about ISIS. We've talked to all the candidates about that for sure. But while we're on it, okay, so let's talk about jobs and the economy. And I'm sure you're hearing, Congressman Ginta, as you're out there on the trail, a lot about stagnating wages, income inequality. People are concerned about the gap between, the richest and the poorest, middle class struggles. So what kind of plans do you back in Congress? If you are returned, what kind of plans do you support to start closing this gap that everybody says they're worried about?
Well, I think first you've got to focus on growth. I believe that in order to have more job creation, you do need economic growth. So there's some things within tax policy that you can do,
like
to try to address that. One thing that we did address earlier. But secondly, you do need to try to have controls over your expenditures so you can match your revenue growth with your revenues over a period of time. But there's other things that we can do. We talk about this issue of the rich getting richer and the poor or the middle class either barely staying afloat or regressing in certain circumstances. And that's true. From 2008 to 2012, the economy here in New Hampshire contracted. And from 2012 to today, we've had very modest growth, maybe 1-2 percentage points at best. That's a net negative from 08 to today. On top of that, people's wages are either the same, which in a sense would be less because of the cost of goods and services have certainly increased over that period of time.
Right, everything's more expensive.
And we're seeing today through the media outlets that energy costs are starting to soar here in the state of New Hampshire, even higher than they already are. So how do you try to deal with that issue? I think one of the things that we can do in the current tax code to try to encourage businesses to have growth here and create real jobs is a very simple tax credit that you provide to any job creator that either increases the number of employees they have or if they give an increase in salary. And the way that that's measurable is through the Social Security tax that businesses pay on a quarterly basis. It's very manageable. It's very objective. If their Social Security tax is going up, they're going to get a tax credit because they're creating jobs or giving raises. That is a way to lift any and all Americans out of the current condition they are. And I think it also serves as an opportunity for business to utilize some of their existing dollars that they have on the shelf right now in their savings accounts for training programs, for education programs, to encourage, again, some of that long-term relationships that companies used to have with employees that we don't so much have today.
Apprenticeships, internships, sure. Training programs. So a tax credit for any business that either hires new folks or raises their salaries, how much would that cost, Congressman Ginta? I mean, a tax credit means the business isn't paying that tax, so there's a hole there.
Yeah, you would – well – it would roughly be the same as what they're paying today. They would get a credit for the increase. So it would come back down to what they're paying today. But the economic output is the fact that you're getting more people back to work, less people on federal resources. And you're also building consumer confidence because there's more dollars in the local economies that individuals are going to spend. That's part of this concern that I see with the long-term economy. Even though you'll see some numbers that suggest certain economic factors are getting better, when you go down Main Street, talk to average people, they don't get the same sense. So their willingness to spend and contribute into a local economy is not matching some of the statistical data that would suggest the economy is slowly increasing to a more favorable position.
What about a minimum wage increase? Some people say that's the way to get more money to people's pockets instead of a sort of complicated tax credit system.
Well, the CBO did come out with a scoring mechanism on the minimum wage and said that that would cost the federal government money and it would cost jobs. I'd like to try to find an opportunity to give everyone a raise in America by providing that tax credit. So, for example, if you're in a minimum wage job and you get a raise, the employer gets a tax credit for that, and we've accomplished both. And it's not just for minimum wage employees, by the way, this proposal that I have. It would be for anyone other than, you know, let's say someone who's already receiving max salary based on Social Security numbers, which are about $117,000. So we're not talking about, high-paying executives or corporate CEOs. We're talking about, the average American who's going to work day in and day out, whether you're starting at minimum wage or whether you're making $1,000 a week or whether, you're making $1,500 a week. That, I think, is going to stimulate opportunity for every single person who's in the workforce, and it provides an opportunity to get those who are not in the workforce to get real upward mobility into a company.
I want to remind everyone that we're speaking with former Manchester Mayor and former 1st District Congressman Frank Ginta. He's the Republican nominee for that congressional seat this time around. And we're taking questions from our audience that they sent in before this event started, also from our live audience here at the Rudman Center at UNH Law. And Congressman Ginta, here's a question that came in on some of the topics that we're talking about. This person says, having worked for many years for the program Women, Infants, and Children, known as WIC, I know that many moms depend on WIC for food, formula, and nutrition. You voted for the Ryan budget that would have made drastic cuts to the WIC program, putting many families in jeopardy. Would you support a budget that would cut a program that gives formula to young moms nationwide? Would you do it again?
So the way the budget process works on the federal level is the budget committee on which I served sets top-line numbers for each of the committees of jurisdiction. And once the budget committee sets that number, it then sends the budget to the committees of jurisdiction to determine how they're going to spend those resources. And those committees will have differences of opinion about how they're going to appropriate dollars line item by line item. In the example of WIC, when it came to the floor of the House, I voted for an amendment to restore those dollars because New Hampshire requires and needs a little additional assistance in the WIC program. LIHEAP program is another one that I voted for an amendment on the floor because there's a definite need in the state of New Hampshire, which may not be a same need in a different part of the country. So the budget process doesn't happen in a week. It starts in February. We're supposed to provide the budget by April 15th, which the House did the years that I was there. And then there's another component that never took place when I served that I think does need to happen. The Senate does need to do its work as well and work on their budget by then bringing the House and the Senate budget together. And then you have a committee of conference to figure out where are the areas of agreement and where are the areas of disagreement.
So you're saying you supported the WIC program, but your amendment didn't make it through to the
no,
final product.
No, it did. The amendment passed. It was an amendment that I voted on. It wasn't mm-hmm. my personal amendment. It was an amendment that I voted on to restore WIC funding.
Because this person's making a criticism, Congressman, that frankly I've heard about the Ryan budget last time around and the Ryan budget that came out, I believe it was this year, that the bulk of the cuts in both of these budgets come from programs that serve low-income Americans, from Medicaid to food stamps and so forth. So I just wonder if you feel that that's the appropriate approach toward budget
cutting. Well, what I think you need to strive for in budgeting is first prioritization. I did this when I was mayor, and I did this to the best I could as a legislator. But you start with prioritization, and then from there, you look at efficiencies within each program, and you try to improve the efficiencies so more of the dollars go into the actual program. Now, the other component of this, which we didn't have when I served, was the economic growth package. We passed 40 or so jobs-related bills in the House of Representatives when I served. Almost two-thirds of those were passed bipartisanly, some with a small number of Democrats.
In the House?
Some, yes.
Really?
Yeah. Some with a small.
That's a pretty partisan place.
Well, when you turn your TV on at night, you get a sense that it is a very partisan place. But the facts actually would suggest a different tale. And this is what I think members and former members or people who are running for office need to try to communicate more effectively. Of the 40 jobs-related bills that we passed, almost two-thirds were passed bipartisanly. Now, some were a very small percentage of Democrats. Some were a higher percentage. Most of those bills ended up not getting a hearing or not getting a vote in the Senate. That's the frustration that I experienced when I served in Congress. And in this Congress, and I'll give a plug for Congresswoman Shea Porter, there are about 380 bills that have passed the House of Representatives, the one that she serves in, that 90% of which passed bipartisanly. And the Senate, by extension, has only voted 21 times. So the House of Representatives is really trying to do the work of the people.
That's interesting because that's not the image that you
get. It's not the
yeah.
I know. This is the frustration, and I'm sure that Congresswoman Shea Porter shares that frustration as well because there is work that's being done bipartisanly that we never get to hear about through the country.
I have to jump in on you there. Sorry, Congressman Ginta. We'll be back in just a moment. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange on NHBR. Welcome to the latest in our series of Rudman Center Conversations with the Candidates at UNH School of Law. Our candidate is Republican Frank Ginta, who's running to regain his seat in the 1st Congressional District. And Congressman Ginta, one more question about income inequality, budgets, deficits, and the Ryan budgets, both the one that was being discussed when you were in Congress and the one that's sort of on the table now. The big critique of this approach by House Budget Committee Chair Paul Ryan is that it, quote unquote, balances the budget on the backs of the poor. And I think that's what our questioner was getting to earlier with the question about WIC, and that's what we were talking about.
Sure.
So just how do you address that concern that this budget kind of hits it to the poor first.
Well, there are so many different perspectives and points of view on the current budget and the budgets that I worked on when I was on the budget committee. And I think the first thing everybody would agree on is budgeting is not easy, no matter what entity you're budgeting for, whether it's the federal government, the state government, or your local community or the city of Manchester when I was mayor, or your home budget. You've got to have priorities. What I try to do is at least communicate to people what the budget process is so people understand that at any point in the process you can amend and change what is evolving over the course of that 3 or 4 month period. What happened, I think, when I served is that the Ryan budget became a political talking point. And rather than talking about more substantive sort of approaches to how do we find common ground amongst House Republicans and House Democrats, that got very cantankerous. And that's what we tend to hear about when we hear media reports. We don't hear about all the other areas of agreement that Republicans and Democrats have. That being said, I don't think anybody wants to, quote unquote, balance the budget on the backs of those who are less fortunate. I want to have the appropriate programming, whether it's at a local level, a state level, or a federal level, for those individuals who are in a position of need. But I also want to balance that with finding the economic growth, the opportunity to provide the existing programs those resources, those bridge resources to individuals. And I'll give you an example. Let's say somebody loses their job. Very difficult thing for somebody to go through. So they'll get welfare assistance. But we have over 18 different agencies. $18 billion worth of dollars over 9 agencies of job training and job-related money at the federal level. The challenge is that there are no real metrics that any oversight committee or committee of jurisdiction looks at to see if those dollars are being utilized efficiently.
So we don't know what we're getting.
That's my concern. So why not consolidate all those programs, put it under one roof, under Department of Labor, have very strict guidelines in terms of congressional House and Senate oversight to make sure those dollars are being used and utilized to those individuals that lose a job, are on welfare for a period of time, get them to a job training program. So there is a path for that person to return to the workforce. And by the way, if they're going to need assistance for daycare, provide those daycare dollars in the realm of looking at the entire amount of dollars that we're spending with the expectation that at some point we're going to get that person a job that is suitable for their experience and their abilities. Those are the areas that I think has not happened. That oversight has not happened in the past that needs to start happening so you can connect with those families who are in desperate need of assistance.
I want to ask you about Medicare, and that was also one of the issues that came up with this Ryan budget. And then I promise we'll move on from that because we have a lot else to talk about, including the threat of terrorism, as you mentioned earlier. But this person wants to know, this person, Todd, thank you, Todd, for the question, how specifically would you put Medicare on a stronger financial ground and protect today's seniors and future retirees from rising health costs? And Todd, thank you again for the question. This gets to what the Ryan budget attempted to do, which was put Medicare on sort of a premium support, or what opponents called a voucher program.
You know, it's interesting. When we were on the budget committee trying to craft a solution for Medicare, it was under the premise we first have a committee hearing. You've got the administrators of Medicaid coming to the committee, communicating the financial stability or lack thereof of the program. And not a political or partisan testimony. Maybe the questions from members were partisan and political, but the testimony is apolitical. The facts are the facts from the administrators of Medicare. And at that time, what they communicated was, if something isn't done within 30 years or so, we're not going to have the financial resources for the projections of existing and future beneficiaries
and
needs.
Aging demographic, baby boomers retiring,
right,
and so forth.
So I would hope that everyone in America would want their member of Congress to work on this issue. And previously, it was, quote unquote, the third rail of politics, right? Nobody ever wanted to talk about Medicare, God forbid, because maybe they wouldn't win their reelection. I kind of have the opposite approach. I think we should talk about it. I think we should hit it head on. I think we should educate as many people as possible about what the challenges are, and then have a national dialogue about what are the best solutions. Because unless and until you do that, you're not going to get a solution that enough of the country appreciates or wants to continue with. So
what about the premium support that Congressman Ryan supported? This caused a lot of controversy.
It did.
Congressman Ginta, people said, seniors will get a voucher to purchase health care. Mm-hmm. It might not be enough to cover the costs. They'll end up paying more out of pocket. There was a lot of angst about this.
There was a lot of angst about it. It first came out in the first budget, and then there was a second iteration, when Senator Rod Wyden, who was on the Senate side, came in the following year with an amendment to it, or a proposal with Paul Ryan, a Republican and a Democrat, to try to insert some stability into the process in the House, signaling that maybe the Senate would work with us on it. Interestingly, and most people don't know this fact, this idea was built upon the Clinton administration's suggestion of trying to do this when President Clinton was in office. And I think when people start to hear that there are multiple people on both sides of the political spectrum that support some notion of a sliding scale based on your ability, not negatively impacting current recipients, but trying to address the 10,000 people per day that are retiring and trying to be honest about that number, coming up with a program that works, that's solvent, the more we talk about it, the more I think you're going to find common ground. And I hope that we find that common ground sooner rather than later.
Is that a means testing then for Medicare? Because some people have said, oh, you can't do that.
I don't believe that was in the original proposal. But you know, in order to go forward, I think you have to start with put everything on the table, get people in a room, and try to find, okay, what are the things that maybe Republicans say absolutely not, and what are the things that Democrats say absolutely not? And you start to whittle down the areas of common ground. And look, I'm an optimist. I think this can happen. I served as a mayor for 4 years as a Republican when we had 14 members of our board. One was an independent, two were Republican, and 11 were Democrat. And I needed 8 votes to get anything accomplished. It forces you to work not through the lens of a political ideology, but it forces you to work through the lens of respect amongst colleagues and what is the goal and objective that we want to try to achieve on behalf of our community. I think Washington needs more of that. There is no question that there is a lot of politicism that goes on the issues that are important issues to every American. And look, are we going to agree on every single solution? No. But if America starts seeing people who are willing to sit at the table, respectfully dialogue with someone from the other side of the aisle, maybe and just maybe people will start to feel a little bit better about the solutions that end up being achieved by those same individuals.
Boy, given the campaign ads I've seen on television, that seems like the land of Oz.
To talk about that for a moment, I'm on the receiving end of on 4 of those ads. To that point, you know, the only ad that I have up running right now is a positive ad about things that I want to try to accomplish. I think people are very frustrated with the notion of negativity and negative ads. Now, I think most political experts would say the reason these ads are done is because they work with a certain segment of people. And that's true. But wouldn't it be nice if we could get away from swing politics or swing elections and get to substantive public policy discussions in a rational way that we're respecting one another.
That's what we're trying to people,
and you do. And
conversations,
Laura,
yeah.
You've always done it. I've known you for years. And that's why I love doing forums like this, because it gives for a much more responsible back and forth on the substantive issues that people very much care about.
Well, I just want to ask you one last quick question on this premium support. Again, the idea of vouchers. You talked about, you know, let's come together, let's talk about solutions. Mm-hmm. How did you personally feel about this, Congressman Ginta, this idea of giving seniors a voucher where they could go out and buy insurance or buy coverage?
I don't call it a voucher. I think that that term was sort of coined by the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, again, as a way to try to politicize the issue. And I'm not saying that the national Republicans don't do this either, I'm not absolving them of their responsibility. But really what we were trying to attempt to do in that legislation, in that proposed legislation, was get something on the table, move the conversation forward in a way that would have an iteration or a second or a third or a fourth iteration of how do we get to yes in terms of passage on the floor of the House in a bipartisan way. The budget did pass. That component didn't go anywhere. The budget itself never got to see the light of day in the Senate. And what happened was we went through the appropriations process one by one to come to some sort of agreement on spending levels. But that's not the way that we should be running the country. At some point, the process has to work.
Well, and you mentioned Ron Wyden earlier. He's a Democratic senator from Oregon, just to let people know. I want to switch gears with you, Congressman Ginta, if we could, and talk a little bit about foreign policy, because that's certainly been a big headline. With the U.S. launching airstrikes against the militant group ISIS in Iraq and Syria, we've been asking all the congressional candidates about this. Where do you stand on this action, Congressman Ginta? Some people say airstrikes are enough. Some people say all the options should be on the table. Where do you stand on this? What's your gut feeling about how deep the U.S. should get involved in this?
Well, let's try to put this into a little bit of context. A year ago, ISIS was about 1,000 strong, and they had very little financial resources, but they were an ever-increasing potential threat. You're hearing now Hillary Clinton, who was then Secretary of State, and you're hearing Leon Panetta, who was previously an advisor to the president, talk about this in a way that pretty much affirms the fact that their opinion was we should have addressed this almost a year ago. I agree with that assessment, in that if we addressed it in a way that eliminated ISIS a year ago or 8 months ago, we probably wouldn't be where we are today with ISIS. Now, this is a complicated region. There are many different groups that want to take the place of ISIS. And this is something that I think as Americans, we've got to start to come to grips with, that there are, if it's not ISIS, it's somebody else that wants to form an organization, a group, have their opinion or their idea of what needs to occur in that region of the country. In this circumstance, they're wanted to eliminate the Christians, which is less than 1% of Iraq. And they were going door to door, essentially, if you don't convert to Islam or our version of Islam, we're going to immediately kill you. And they were doing this to women, to children.
It was
graphic.
What
and it
do
was,
you think the U.S. should do, Congressman Ginta? I mean, Congress will have a role in this as, you know, as these policies roll out.
So
what's your feeling?
I believe that there needs to be a war vote based on the War Powers Act. I think what is happening in Iraq and Syria fits the definition of war. And at the very least, the United States of America should take the vote, number one. Number two, what that would require is for the president to provide Congress, the House and the Senate, with a clear action plan. And I don't feel like we have a clear action plan today as to what the goal and objective is. And I think that's because the line has been moved several times over the course of the last few weeks. Now, I think most Americans would agree with the fact that we should, and I share this opinion, eliminate ISIS as an organization.
Can you do that with airstrikes?
It has to be more than airstrikes. Now, the airstrikes are a start, but there should have been, and there still can continue to be, a converging of different countries that do fulfill certain components of a mission that are required. And you saw last week Turkey take a vote to put actual troops on the ground, somewhat because of their self-interest, but also because the region is going to require it. So I would like to see all sorts of different countries immediately respond. led by American forces. And I think if we can minimize to the existing level of American troops which exist today, whether we like it or not, there are troops on the ground today. They're called advisors. You could limit it to that number if we have full and complete cooperation from our allies in the region, led by an American force, and then I think we can eliminate this threat. But we have to be careful and honest with the country. Leon Panetta this week said, look, this could potentially be a 30-year war now, or a 30-year action. Nobody wants to see war. I don't want to see war. I served as a mayor when we lost an officer in the line of duty. I've had to take votes in Congress. You know, the Libya action, for example, I voted against that. I would have voted against the action that came to the floor of the House, as Congresswoman Shea Porter did, maybe for different reasons than Congresswoman Shea Porter. But until we see a very clear and definitive plan, I don't think it makes sense to put American troops in harm's way. I'd like to make sure that it's clear, definitive, and that we understand what the goal and objectives are, and we understand what the challenges are and what that could potentially mean for our servicemen and women who would be going over there.
Some people are looking back in time, looking at our first forays into Iraq in the early 2000s. Some are saying we shouldn't have done that in the first place. Some are saying we shouldn't have gotten out so early because that left a vacuum for ISIS to fill in Iraq. What do you think, Congressman Ginta?
Well, you know, look, hindsight is 20/20, and I go back to the day that America was attacked. And I go back to that moment in my mind and in my stomach and what was going through, the thoughts that I had. And I try to place myself back in time as to what the country was feeling, wanting, and needing. There was a threat that killed more than 3,000 Americans on our soil. That should not be forgotten. And in the context of were we right or wrong, I don't want to necessarily second-guess people. I want to try to put a plan in place that's going to be effective. But the reality is we needed to eliminate a threat that killed 3,000 Americans on American soil.
But that threat came from Afghanistan, not Iraq.
Well, there's again, you're talking about a geographic region that today you could argue doesn't have borders. I mean, when you look at Syria and Iraq right now, ISIS has a large swath of land over both countries. And, you know, I went to Afghanistan when I served in Washington. Very complicated, challenging issues at the time. I wasn't in Congress, obviously, at the time. But at this point, I think you've got to look at the threat in front of you. The likelihood of their success if you don't act and ensure that you do everything you can to adhere to the Constitution, to adhere to our legal system, and make sure that you protect every American citizen.
And this is getting right into something that I'm going to ask you about after a short break, Congressman Ginta, privacy rights, how you balance people's privacy rights versus trying to protect the public from another attack like 9/11, which you just mentioned. So we'll talk about that after the break. Also, of course, the Affordable Care Act, so-called Obamacare. We'll discuss that. And a couple other questions from our audience here. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange on NHPR. Welcome back to our campaign series of Rudman Center Conversations with the Candidates at UNH School of Law. Our candidate tonight is Republican congressional nominee Frank Ginta, a former congressman and former Manchester mayor. And Congressman Ginta, just before the break, we were starting to get into that issue that came out after 9/11, is still with us today, the balance of privacy rights versus obviously protecting the public from another attack. During your campaign to win the nomination this summer, there was a moment that a lot of people remembered. Your primary opponent said he would not have supported the Patriot Act, which gave the government widespread authority to gather information in an attempt to avoid another attack. You replied, you either stand with the terrorists or you stand with freedom and protecting Americans. What's your view, Congressman Ginta, on how open-ended the government's rights are to ferret out information that might protect the public?
Well, you do have to have a balance between protecting America and also ensuring American privacy rights. This is a very challenging time that we're in, and it's why it's the most important time to make sure that we get it right. There are a lot of people who are concerned about the challenges of how do we ensure that those fighting in Iraq and Syria don't somehow either access our country or create a sleeper cell a lone wolf here or somebody that tends to react based on an ideology that they somehow have transferred to over time. So I try to put these circumstances in the context of what is in the best interest of safety and how do we accomplish that, but then also how do we constitutionally protect an individual and an individual civil liberty. And I think the way you do that moving forward, knowing that the Patriot Act is going to come up for another vote, I think it's in 2015, there will be a very long and serious discussion both in committee as well as on the House floor. And I think there are a number of things that you can do to ensure that, A, the act is not abused, or that whatever is in the act is not misinterpreted or interpreted inappropriately, and to make sure that it's very, very narrow in scope. I think a couple of ways you can do that is create a civil liberties board to make sure that there is no misunderstanding or misinterpretation of the law, number one. I think you need more transparency relative to the warrant process. I think you need to ensure that subpoenas are required when and only when you have sufficient authority based on the evidence that is procured. Those are things that have to be taken seriously. And I think that Congress, both the House and the Senate, given the fact that we have been through this over the years, are very sensitive to it, understand that the American public are very sensitive to it, and I think that you can find that right balance in ensuring that we're going to do everything we can to protect Americans as when you take the oath you're required to, but make sure that your civil liberties is not in question or not in jeopardy.
Well, as you know, earlier this year, there was a public outcry about this issue. People felt like they were being spied on. The National Security Agency's bulk collection of phone records was a big issue. And in May, the House voted to end that bulk collection of American phone records, but almost no other major provision designed to restrict NSA surveillance. What do you think, Congressman Ginta? Is that an acceptable balance, or do you feel like more limits on the NSA are needed?
Well, actually, when I was in Congress, I voted to restrict the NSA in a lot of the things that we're talking about now. Where I think what went very wrong is that I think the administration or the NSA itself actually went farther than the act allowed them to do. And that's when people got angry. And they rightfully so should have gotten angry. So I think ending bulk collection is really just the tip of the iceberg. You have to ensure, I mean, how many people actually trust and have faith in the federal government right now? It's a very small percentage. So what that says to me is whoever is serving in the House and the Senate, the oversight provision, the oversight authority of Congress has to be adjudicated in such a way that Americans feel that their members of Congress are working on their behalf and that we have a duty and obligation to ensure that there is no abuse of power or authority by any individual or any agency.
You did vote in 2011 to reauthorize several provisions of the Patriot Act, even when critics like Rand Paul were trying to offer amendments to curb warrantless wiretaps, unlimited searches of business records, and so forth. So have you been consistent on this?
Yes, I think I have. Look, there's all different points of view and perspective from the left to the right on the Patriot Act and again, balancing security and safety. My goal and objective is to read through the legislation, amend it as necessary, and try to find that middle ground that's going to be acceptable. Not every piece of legislation that comes to the floor is something that you agree or like 100%, which is why you've got to try to have this back and forth in terms of finding that middle ground that's acceptable to everybody. And I think that's always a work in progress with Congress or with any legislative deliberative body. But my sense going forward, because of what I think was illegal by the NSA, not authorized by Congress, No Congress authorized the NSA to do what they did. That serves as an opportunity for future Congresses
to keep
an eye on it and work together and make sure that, you know, the sort of faith in the American people that the American people have of the institution of Congress is restored. Because right now, I think people just don't feel like there's someone minding the store and that that these things are being addressed in a way that they should.
Here's a question that came from our audience. This person says, if Republicans in Congress are unable to repeal Obamacare in the next session, what are some measures you would work on to improve the health care system in the short term? That's a good question, and I also want to ask you another question about Obamacare.
Sure.
Thank you to that person.
The way I would answer that is let's start with logic. I mean, the President of the United States, who this is his signature legislation, is not going to repeal his own legislation. And I think most people know that. There is not going to be an ability to repeal the Affordable Care Act between now and 2016. So the question becomes, what can you do to modify it, change it, improve it, negate some of the challenges that people are having with it? And that is, I think, a question that all of us need to sort of answer in a way that doesn't just say, oh, you're either for or against. It's not either you're for the Affordable Care Act or you want to go back to what it replaced. That's sort of a false premise that a lot of people like to put in front of candidates.
That's what Democrats have been saying, that you guys are all about repeal, yeah, that you don't have a plan. So
plan? There are plans in the House and plans in the Senate. I don't know why my friends on the other side of the aisle say that there is no plan when there are plans.
What do those look like?
They're actually pretty, I think, pretty favorable to this notion. Two areas that I hear a lot are age 26. Can you keep your insurance up to age 26? Number one. And number two, would you get rid of the limits? Republican plans in the House and the Senate include both of those provisions.
Limits on?
On the amount that you can spend for in an individual. Those were two of the those are the top two issues that I would hear consistently across
the
different
ideas,
Republicans, Democrats, and independents, that they would want these things. So guess what? The Republican plans that the Democrats claim don't exist actually include those in their plans. So if you had a repeal and replace bill that actually got to the floor and got to the Senate and got to the president's desk, those things would be in there. What I think people like myself want to change is this notion that the federal government is forcing individuals who don't want to purchase something. I just don't think that that is the best way to approach the reduction of cost and greater access. Here in New Hampshire, we have currently one exchange, in addition to the New Hampshire Public Radio Exchange. But we have one exchange relative to health care.
We're getting more, though, very soon.
We are getting more, but you know, let me talk about this one first, and I can get into the other ones. This is a very narrow exchange. It didn't have to happen that way. Right now, in the first congressional district, people in Portsmouth are denied ability to go to Portsmouth Hospital, and people in Rochester are denied going to Frisbee Hospital. I don't think anybody wanted that. If you supported the Affordable Care Act from day one, that's not what you supported. So there are unintended consequences of legislation. So we should try to fix that. I think the way to fix that is not require or demand more exchanges, because some of these are going to be narrow in scope. They're not going to be statewide. They're going to be geographic in nature, as they claim. And let's see if they actually come to fruition. What I'd rather see is sort of an open opportunity to have 20, 25 carriers come back to the state like we once had. So there's real, true competition for either the individual or the small employer or medium-sized employer from which to choose. That can absolutely drive down the cost that you're seeing both to the employer and to the employee. And then there are things that you can do to those. Because I always get asked this question, I'm sure you're going to ask it. Well, what happens to the people who are currently receiving benefits through the Affordable Care Act?
40,000 on exchanges, 20,000 on expanded Medicaid.
Some of those people were forced because they lost their coverage. Those people would probably go back to identifying something they prefer for their family. But you can have what we used to have in the state of New Hampshire, which is a safety net for those on a sliding scale that need access to health care. That went away by legislative action, by state legislative action, after the Affordable Care Act came into existence.
Well, we've expanded Medicaid now.
You can return
the same
that.
Thing, or?
No,
the subsidies and the exchanges that helps lower income folks as well.
The Medicaid expansion is different than what we had previously. But again, as the state legislature, because that will sunset at some point. So I believe there was a sunsetting provision of that expansion program. So the state legislature and whoever the governor is will take a look at, okay, if for hypothetical, the Affordable Care Act is repealed. What is it that we should be doing on a state basis to make sure that those individuals who are in a socioeconomic position to require assistance, how do they get it? But I don't think you need the Affordable Care Act in order to provide that.
Do you think, Congressman Ginta, that at the very minimum, the Affordable Care Act has lit a fire under people to say, all right, maybe we do need to cover people.
I don't like the way
Obama's doing it, but at least we need to cover folks.
I've said that in the past.
So you're giving him credit for that.
Absolutely. The president said he wanted to change this area, and he certainly did. And it has forced a conversation. I wish that we didn't get to this point. I wish we could have resolved some of the differences or the challenges without getting to this point, because you cannot ignore those small businesses that, you know, reach out to the delegation, Republican or Democrat, current delegation, and say, I can't afford the massive increase, which my carrier is telling me it's because of the mandates that the Affordable Care Act are providing.
Some research shows the premiums are actually going down in some states, or that the increases have moderated in some states.
I can tell you in New Hampshire, I try to get my research not through the lens of a Democrat researcher or a Republican researcher. I try to go to the individuals that just have the pure facts. So I've gone and met with the insurance brokers and agents in the state, and I say they don't provide me the actual name of the company. They have to keep that confidential. But they'll provide me a list of companies based on the number, the geographic region that they're in, the number of employees, and the type of industry they're in. And they'll show me the different increases or decreases. About 95% are getting some sort of increase. And there's no rhyme or reason to the increase of a company, of similar companies in a same region, same number of employees, same industry. That frustrates the not just the employer or that business owner, but the individual who's dealing the human resources office of each and every one of those companies, because they just don't know what they're going to be able to afford for next year. And then as a mayor, former mayor, I'm sorry, this is important. As a former mayor, cities are now going to go through being taxed for their quote-unquote Cadillac plants, because municipalities and communities are providing good plans to their employees. And if they have
I
was mayor of Manchester. I city of Manchester employees have great health benefits, and they deserve it. But that's a local decision that's made at the local level. Now with the Cadillac tax, there's concern that communities like Manchester or other large communities are going to have to make significant and serious adjustments to and not be able to provide the same service that they're providing to existing employees. And that doesn't seem to me to be fair in trying to create more access or greater affordability.
Well, we could probably do 6 more hours on health care, so I'll leave it at that, but would love to dig into that more with you at some later date. I did want to ask you, Congressman Ginta, because we talked to Scott Brown, the Republican nominee for Senate, about this as well when he joined us. The new New Hampshire GOP platform includes what's called personhood language, saying that the party supports the pre-born child's fundamental right to life and personhood under the 14th Amendment. Do you support this plank, Congressman Ginta? And if so, what would that mean if it were embodied into law? Would it outlaw abortion in all instances?
Well, look, I would have preferred, like a lot of people, that the Republican Party, when they had their event, not try to address this issue, because it's a very personal issue to people, and it's a very emotional issue. When this discussion was occurring, and I think I heard the interview when Scott answered the question.
Yeah, he didn't agree with it.
No, he didn't agree with it. But I look at it from the perspective of when I was mayor, I was on a ride-along within the first 3 months of being mayor, and a woman was killed by a drunk driver. I think it was on Maple Street, and she was in a cab. She was on her way home, and she was pregnant. She was killed. You can't look at these issues through one lens. We've got to start communicating these issues in a larger sense of these issues and try to, rather than play, you know, an I gotcha political game, try to take them in the emotional way that deserves respect from different points of view.
Because you're saying there's two deaths in that.
Well, in my view, there were two deaths because she was 8 months pregnant. So I offer a different perspective, not to try to be critical, but just to offer a different perspective of the issue and what can we do to find, because I think most people would say, well, in that circumstance, if you don't change the law, the individual who killed the mother would only be tried for one death, not two. So I offer that as perspective and say, are there ways that we can look at it a little bit differently and try to keep, you know, more of an intellectual dialogue rather than just a political one?
Well, so do you support the personhood amendment in the plank, or do you wish it were not in there?
Well, look, the state party wants to do what it's going to do. It did that. I'm focused basically on trying to talk about it through this lens. But they made the decision to do it. So if that's what they wanted to do, that's their right to do it.
Well, Congressman Ginta, I think we have to wrap it up there. Mm-hmm. And I do apologize for cutting you short there because I have a couple more questions.
Sure.
I'd like to ask you. But thank you very much for being with us. And that is all the time we have. I'd like to thank everybody who came out and let you know that our next forum is with Republican gubernatorial nominee Walt Havenstein. You can go to nhpr.org for more information, including a complete forum schedule. I want to thank all of you for being in our audience tonight, especially the team at NHPR and UNH Law. And again to you, Congressman Ginta, for being with us. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
This is The Exchange on NHPR.